This week, we're talking all about offensive linemen. Does it make sense to invest big money up front? One strong point that the league's best O-line seem to have in common, our ranking of the top 10 offensive linemen in football, and a Q&A with Bucks left tackle Donovan Smith. It's all on the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. I'm Gary Gramling. He is Andy Minoy. It's a little later in the show. We're going to have a special guest, even more special than the two of us. Donovan Smith of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers will join us for a conversation because this show is all about offensive linemen.
Yeah, real football fans only here this week.
I don't know.
Casual listener, we don't want you. This is about hand placement, footwork, leverage.
There's no more like casual football fan. If you are a casual football fan, you now understand the importance of offensive linemen. If you're like a fantasy football player.
Well, what do you think of casual fan? I guess what I'm saying, like, do you think the casual fan knows who Teron Armstead is?
Yeah.
How the hell Teron Armstead get a vote in our top polls is also what I'm starting to wonder.
Okay, wait. And I didn't vote for him, but I will defend him as a guy you can make a case top 20.
Yeah, no, I'm. You know what I was doing? I was thinking of Jermon Bushrod for a second there. Yes. Teron Armstead is a good player. He's a good left. He was not as healthy recently as you'd like, but he's. I take back what I said about Teron Armstead.
There you go.
He's a very good left tackle when he's healthy. I'd like him to be healthy more often.
Well, I'm glad we cleared that up, and then
Bushrod. Now there's a guy you shouldn't play with.
Yeah, that's another story. But let's keep it optimistic. Let's talk about the offensive linemen we like, and we are going to unveil our ranking of the top 10 offensive linemen in the NFL today later in the show. But first, we have some things to talk about offensive line play in general, and this is kind of a big topic. This is a big philosophical debate, Andy, but I guess the question is, do you need to invest big in sort of star headlining offensive linemen in the NFL? Or is the goal more, and we've talked about this a little bit, is it more just to get an offensive line that isn't disastrously bad, that is just good enough to allow you to function?
Yeah, we've gone over this before, and it's a moving argument. There's a scale to this argument because I think a lot of it begins with who you have at quarterback and how you play that way. Every offense takes on the shape of its quarterback. So who's your QB? Because if you have a guy who's getting the ball out quickly, if you're the New England Patriots, for example, you don't need to re-sign Nate Solder for top-end money or Trent Brown for top-end money. You can get by with mid-round draft picks or even an undrafted center like David Andrews, who's gotten a lot better over time, because you have a quarterback that controls the protections and gets the ball out on 3 and 5 step timing pretty often. But if you're the Philadelphia Eagles, for example, and they're kind of a quick strike offense as well, but your QB tends to play late into the down within the pocket like Carson Wentz does, it's a different conversation. The Eagles have a lot of good offensive linemen, of course. The one that complicates it for me, Gary, is the Indianapolis Colts are kind of somewhere in between there. They've got the superstar QB. They get the ball out quickly, and yet they invested heavily via the draft lately in their offensive line. And I thought that was overkill. I didn't love the Quentin Nelson pick because I thought they needed more help on defense and Luck could compensate for a bad O-line. But there's no doubt that that offensive line in Indianapolis was the biggest reason that team looked like a contender last year, which would mean I would have been wrong about Nelson and wrong about the approach. Investing in the O-line helped them a lot. So I don't know where I stand on this now.
Yeah, I was going to say, and just to clear that up, conceptually, Andy didn't like taking an offensive lineman. Before this turns into another 20-second Twitter clip that
Quentin Nelson, I was fine with them taking the lineman that they took. I didn't like them taking a lineman in general at that pick. And again, I was more than wrong about that one.
So to me, I think it's almost the same thing at this point. Investing in an offensive line that will be, quote-unquote, good enough, I think that is big money at this point. I think if you're bringing a veteran, you look back, Nate Solder, who we talked about. Nate Solder's not a game-changing left tackle. He's solid is what he probably was in New England, and he was probably a little less than that in his first year in New York. We'll see how second year goes with the Giants. But you go back to even, you know, the Vikings getting Riley Reiff and Mike Remmers. Mike Remmers probably a swing tackle, really, but they had to pay those guys pretty big money.
Yeah, and Remmers was a disaster, and so they wound up getting rid of him, and they're trying it all over again with Josh Klein. But it's like you said it, right, the left tackle's not a game changer. The problem I've had for a long time, and I'm just having a conversation now, is name one tackle that is a game changer, because you can't really do much to scheme with your offensive line unless you are a super run-heavy team, and there are more teams starting to do that again. Dallas, Baltimore, and those teams should be investing in offensive linemen. But for the most part, it's a quick strike passing NFL. And so you can't game change with your linemen because you can't do – all they are insurance policies in your pass protection, so they're really expensive insurance policies.
Yeah, I mean, I would have answered your question with Tyron Smith. I would also – I guess I'd point out, you look at the Texans, and it's obvious to look at the Texans' offensive line and see the problems because they gave up no sacks in football last year, but their offensive line was so bad, it changed the way they played. They had to accommodate it with keeping an extra blocker in, which now you're changing your offense to make up for the fact that you don't have five guys who can block.
Right, and your quarterback in his second year, I thought, took a step back at times because he didn't trust his offensive line. Deshaun Watson played a little bit rushed in the pocket. He held the ball at times, and it's partly because the guys who would have been his eligible receivers were staying in and blocking and helping those offensive linemen who struggled. So absolutely, there's no question. It's like you almost need a sweet spot. Like you need, if you were to give a letter grade and C is an average offensive lineman, and A is a Pro Bowler, you at least need a B to run your offense, I would say.
Yeah, and I feel like you have to do it through the draft at this point. Almost more than any other. I mean, you can't really get a great quarterback on the open market, but I think that's the way you got to do it if you're building your offensive line.
And then here's the challenge that comes with that. Is let's say the lineman's talented, but he's not quite ready to play mentally. Well, you can't have that at the offensive line spot. Yeah. You have to react to immediate pressure, and pressure designs and defensive fronts are getting more creative by the week in the NFL. So veteran linemen, it takes a lot of intelligence to play offensive line. There was a stereotype many years ago that it was just big, dumb meatheads, and that's not at all what offensive linemen are. Next to quarterbacks, they're the smartest players on the field almost always, especially as you get inside the center position, even some of the guard positions where you get a lot of bodies around you, a lot of subtleties. It's hard to play offensive line. So you draft them because they're so expensive, which is happening at other positions, but you've got to have a guy that can also be counted on mentally right now. And you know what, Gary, there's a reason offensive line coaches tend to be the highest paid assistants on every staff. Next to coordinators, perhaps, but even some teams, they pay their own line coach more. And there's a reason that once you're an offensive line coach, that's pretty much where you stay. You don't branch out a whole lot because when a team finds a good one, they grab on to that guy. And a big problem Minnesota last year that no one talked about when that offensive line fell apart was Tony Sparano died in the early part of the season. Before the season, they never replaced him. So offensive line coaches are immensely valuable because you need teachers in that role.
Well, let's talk about a position we don't talk about that much on this show, which kind of surprising. We talk about all positions a lot. We just talk about football. That's what the show is mostly about. But let's talk about centers. And I kind of look around the league and I look at the top offensive lines, and it seems like, you know, whether it's Dallas, whether it's Pittsburgh, whether it's Philadelphia, who I will loosely say those are three of the top five lines in the league. They all have centers. They all have reliable centers. And you kind of you mentioned it a little bit here, and we've talked about it a little bit in the past. It's like the further inside you play on the offensive line, the more cerebral a player you have to be because you're processing so much in front of you. There are so many more options that the defense can show you and throw at you. is it time to kind of look at the center and say, this is maybe how we should build this thing? You get your center and then you build out from the middle of it.
Yeah, I would say it's time to do that at all the positions. The Eagles, for example, they go out of their way to tell you that Jason Kelce is, they don't say he's the most valuable guy on our team. I don't think teams necessarily view it like that. Guys have different roles, but they make it clear that Kelce is as valuable as anybody in any situation to the Philadelphia Eagles. Travis Frederick's valuable to Dallas. You need a center who understands what he's doing. If you have one that can be partly your quarterback, that can help read the fronts and make the calls, which is what Kelce often does, that can have a real domino effect because everybody around the center now trusts the calls and they're in the right protections or even in the running game. It's not just in the run blocking, hey, run over the guy in front of you, let's move the line of scrimmage. You have assignments in the run game, especially as a zone team and even as a man team, a man blocking team, that is. So it's somebody has to get those assignments sorted out, and you can't do it until you line up and see where the defense is. Center is almost always the guy that does it. I do think that's immensely valuable. And I think the second most valuable position along the offensive line these days, Gary, is the guard position, inside out.
Brian Allen in LA. That's going to be a fascinating one to me.
They're comfortable with him. I thought so too. But I've talked, I think they're pretty comfortable with Brian Allen at center.
I mean, John Sullivan, and we talked about that playoff performance he had against the Cowboys last year, which was kind of out of character for him. He's never been quite a dominant player, but he was such a steadying force in the middle of that line.
John Sullivan, so I was, when I did that interview with McVay, I said to him that I think, here's how I know that they're comfortable with Brian Allen, because I said to McVay, John Sullivan strikes me as the type of guy you're going to get up to September 1st and say, hey, we're a playoff contending team. We're a Super Bowl contending team. We're not messing around at this position. Just go get John, sign him for one more year. We know that he knows what he's doing. And let's not have to worry about it. And McVay, yeah, I kind of agree with that. Who do you think will sign him? And I said, you guys. I'm talking about you guys would sign him. And that's how he said, no, we like Brian Allen quite a bit. But the sentiment was clear. John Sullivan is a plug-and-play type of veteran. The problem is, and this happens with a lot of linemen, it happens with a lot of football players, but his body's starting to break down. And there are some, I remember Mark Schlereth said that he had a chance to continue his career. Mark Schlereth was a guard for the Broncos in the Elway years. He played at other times and other teams, but Mark Schlereth was an Iron Man player, had 1,000 surgeries in his career, had a chance to continue his career as a backup, and passed on the opportunity, not because he thought he was above that job, but because he didn't think he could keep his body warm enough sitting on the bench. He's got to either play or not play. There's no in between when you get to that age. So John Sullivan, he's 32, 33. His body's starting to tell him no more. And it's all or nothing for guys like that, I've heard.
He's got to be a two-way player then. Play a little defensive tackle.
That's an excellent solution, Gary, and it's amazing to me you don't run a front office.
You've already got Aaron Donald there. How much else you need on the interior line?
John Sullivan, another thing I'd like to do, and maybe people could do nominations for this, because along with our all-average team, I have it. This one takes a lot of research, because a lot of thinking. I'd like to do the all-second act team or the all-second chance team, guys who got better late in their career when they joined a new team. Think of like Kyle Van Noy, for example, who gave Sullivan fits in the Super Bowl, by the way. Kyle Van Noy was a Lions linebacker, really wasn't much of a player as a second-round pick, goes to New England, and I thought was one of their most valuable players last year. John Sullivan, to me, would be the center on the all-second chance team because he's been better with the Rams than he was as a Viking. Not to say he wasn't a decent center as a Viking for all those years.
All right, so send your all-second chance team nominations. Do that, but only do it after you've sent your all-average team nominations.
Are we getting a lot of response on that, or do we need to push it more?
Well, we get a fair amount. Sporadic.
So the all-average team, for those of you who don't know, we want to hear, and where do they send this?
Talkback@themmqb.com is the best place.
We're trying to put together the team that is as average as possible. So which players best embody mediocrity at their position? Who is Dante Moncrief's another one that comes to mind for me. Who are the Dante Moncriefs around the NFL? Just a plug and play. he's kind of okay enough guy.
You're going to get so much heat from the Dante Moncrief fans.
I did on Twitter this week. Did you see that?
I did see that.
That's how do you? I don't know how you see all these tweets, because I some of these tweets I get that I put out, I swear nobody sees them, and you always know what I've tweeted.
Well, because I have a tweet deck that follows everyone and their mentions on our staff, even though I don't tweet myself. So there you go.
That's a very accurate and disappointing answer, because I thought maybe you were going to say, "I go, no, you'd be surprised, Andy, how much how far your tweets spread." I'm on a list, you said. All right.
I was in Kuala Lumpur, and all they were talking about was Andy Benoit's tweets. I am a Dante Moncrief believer. We've talked about this on the show every once in a while. I like him. I don't love him, but I thought I liked him more than just about anyone. And the fact that all these people came out of the woodworks, I feel like I found my brethren. I found my, my people I should be hanging out with. So there you go.
A lot of Moncrief talk for our O-line list show here.
I know. I guess it's time to move on. Just a quick programming note. Bad Football Movies episode out right now. I just want to hear real quick what you think of this, Andy. Rudy.
As a movie?
As a bad football movie.
No, that's I would say that's borderline disrespectful, because Rudy was a good football movie. This podcast ought to just be called Football Movies. And so, first of all, there's not enough football movies out there to separate the good and the bad ones anyway.
There are more than you think. We still have a pretty long list, but I'm kind of with you in that the movie is good. Connor Orr and I were discussing this. Does the real life Rudy, the story, the epilogue here with him and the things he did that were pretty sleazy, does that bother you?
I don't know if I'm up on those things. I know that Joe Montana said a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, that when we hoisted Rudy up on our shoulders and took him off the field, we were just goofing around.
Yes. That is true. I mean, that of course it's true. That would be absurd. He's a bunch of college kids.
Where he said that.
No, he pulled off some white collar crime. Took took responsibility for it, which I guess is the first step towards recovery. There's a path towards redemption for him, I suppose. But it's just not a very heartwarming story when you look at the whole life of it.
All right, well, then I guess it's a bad movie. I don't know what you want me to say here. I'm going to look up the crime, but I'd rather talk. I mean, Rudy didn't even play offensive line either, did he? No. Was Rudy? He was a kicker or something?
He was a pass rusher. He was really a special teamer, but he was on defense on that one play. When he was the guy who sacked the quarterback.
Oh, that was right. I guess the more I think about this, I guess I do think it's not a great. I don't remember much about it. I saw it in college.
I thought the movie was good. The real story, meh, not so much. All right, back to the show. Donovan Smith coming up in a little bit. But first, our unveiling of the top 10 offensive linemen in football. And I'm sorry, this irritates people every year, but we do combine the offensive line positions into one. It's just how we do it.
We should apologize for that, because that always irritates me. I get irritated when places don't differentiate between left guard and right guard. So that is fair criticism of us, and it's a scheduling issue. We don't have enough time to go through every single position every week like this, because eventually the real football season starts.
Yeah. I mean, if they condense the football season and start in October, we can discuss this. But these are our rankings. I'm about to start reading them. Our third voter this week, Colin Bowers, one of our researchers in NBA.
Well, hold on, Gary. Colin Bowers is almost like a voter emeritus, because he left me as a researcher last year because he got a job working for the NBA.
Yes.
I wrote him a letter of recommendation begrudgingly because I didn't want to lose him, but he'd earned it, and he does a great job there. He is a whiz with numbers, but he knows offensive line play. So I was talking with him this week, and he joined us for this one.
I was going to say, he's a basketball guy, so please, if you don't like any of these rankings, blame the basketball guy. But we are starting, as always, with a highlight of the show, which is others receiving votes. votes. 29 players got votes this week because we all vote for the top 20. So I will read those names really quick, and then we will get to the top 10 as Andy sits in pain and endures. Here we go. Kevin Zeitler, Brandon Scherf, Ryan Kelly, Joel Bitonio, Ronnie Stanley, Taylor Luan, Joe Staley, Mike Pouncey, Shaq Mason, Dwayne Brown, Marshall Yanda, Andris Pete, Roger Saffold, Teron Armstead, Alex Mack, Laramie Tunzel, Ryan Ramchick, Lane Johnson, Andrew Whitworth. Congratulations to all of them. Top 10. Number 10, Trent Williams. Number 9, Marquise Pouncey. Number 8, Mitchell Schwartz. I do want to start with Trent Williams here, who is in something of a strange situation in Washington. Reportedly unhappy with the way his injury was treated. It could have something to do with the fact that his contract is winding down, and he's probably looking at what every other offensive tackle who has signed in the past couple years has gotten and saying, I should probably be getting that. But my question to you, Andy, Trent Williams, considering what he is, I mean, he's been a superstar player over the course of his career. He has been banged up the last couple years. He is now, he is 30 years old. He'll be 31 very soon in July. But if you were, say, the Cleveland Browns, a playoff team or a team with playoff aspirations that needed a left tackle, would you trade a first-round pick for Trent Williams at this point?
Ooh, a first-round pick. That's tough. I mean, salary cap-wise, the Browns can absorb Trent Williams mm-hmm. and be fine as far as I understand. Does that seem accurate to you?
It does.
Okay. So let's say that's accurate. Would I give up a first-round pick for Trent Williams? Because the Browns are going with Greg Robinson at left tackle. And he was fine last year in the second half of last season, which to me amounts to trying to catch lightning in a bottle twice to plug him in for this year, because mm-hmm. he has not been even remotely close to fine with the Rams or with the Lions before that. I mean, he wasn't even in the competition to start very long for the Rams near the end. So you've got all these weapons in Cleveland. You have a great young QB, Odell Beckham. You have a deep backfield. The rest of your O-line is pretty good. You have this one potentially glaring weak spot that could fell it off. If you have a gaping hole in your offensive line, then teams not only can exploit that hole, but they can scheme to exploit it, and then you're limited in having to counter all that. So make it go away by trading a first-round pick for Trent Williams. I don't know if I would go first-rounder. I think you could get him for less. He's going to be 31 in August.
Some of these guys age well, though. I mean, Andrew Whitworth aged well.
Yeah, you're right.
I should have had other guys ready to mention at this point, but
Jason Peters, but Peters has aged relatively. He's aged well in the sense that he plays at a high level into his late 30s. I guess he's aged well. He's had some injuries. Trent Williams has had some injuries in his career. Whitworth has never been an injury guy.
That's true. I'd do it. I'd do it if I were Cleveland.
You would?
Yeah.
Joe Staley ages well as well. He's mm-hmm. better now than he was a few years ago, and I bet Mike McGlinchey stays at right tackle for quite a while because of that. So the thing is, if you're the Browns, it's not like you've signed a bunch of free agents and this is your year. It's not like that Dream Team Eagles team a few years ago, or you know, insert any team that's just gone all in right now. They've got a few. They're just getting started. They're going to be a contender for the next several years.
They are, but how much are you going to be able to spend in free agency? You know, you're going to in 3 years pay Baker, in a couple years Myles Garrett is up. You're going to have to pay him a premium. I don't know. I think they have a window to spend right now. Lord knows they have enough young guys on that roster that, you know, is a first-round pick worth quite as much to them as it is to, you know, just sort of generic Team X?
Yeah. It's a good question. It's a really good question. One thing Williams gives you, and we'll talk more about this with some of these other guys, Tunzel, actually, who I think could be in this list. He didn't quite make it, but Tunzel is immensely athletic. Mm-hmm. They give you a perimeter screen game, and Cleveland would make good use of that. So when I said that earlier in the show, I said, well, you can't create a lot with your offensive line schematically. That was a little bit misguided in the sense that you can do stuff with your screen game specifically and outside zone running as well, but everybody does outside zone running. The stuff you can do that you wouldn't normally do, you can do some perimeter screens with a guy like Trent Williams, who's amazing running the alley down in space. So I'll put it this way, Gary, if the Browns did make that trade, I would not at all be up in arms about it, because the other thing is they don't have very much depth along their offensive line. They don't have any depth along their offensive line, which means it's Greg Robinson or nothing. So I would be fine if they did make the trade.
Marquise Pouncey is a guy who a little bit polarizing. He's a guy who gets overwhelmed every once in a while by big defensive tackles. He is, he what they ask him to do, I feel like the range he has is sort of something that is not replicated by any other center in the league.
I agree. That's a better example of expanding your screen game. Pouncey gives it to you. David DeCastro gives it to you. And the Steelers really rely on that. One thing that's interesting about Pittsburgh, I've had coaches around the AFC North say, you know, the Steelers, they don't do a lot with their protections. They're not overly complicated. If they feel they're in the wrong protection, they just throw hot. Roethlisberger will just get the ball out right away. So it'd be interesting to see that offensive line in Pittsburgh. They were the best in the NFL last year, at least in pass protection. They were far and away the best, I thought. And Pouncey was a big part of that.
Mitchell Schwartz was number 8, by the way, which we already mentioned. We talk about Mitchell Schwartz a lot.
Yeah, we did
Mitchell
last
Schwartz
week.
On this. Yeah. Basically, every show we have the Mitchell Schwartz hour at some point. So we'll move on to 7 through 5 here. Number 7, David DeCastro, who we just mentioned, Pittsburgh Steelers guard. Number 6, another guard, Quentin Nelson. And number 5, Travis Frederick. I do want to touch on Frederick real quick. Missed all last season, obviously, with the Guillain-Barre syndrome. What did you see from Dallas's offense that was different, and what does Frederick returning bring back to that offense?
I thought Joe Looney did a really nice job filling in for Travis Frederick last year. He's not as good as Frederick, but I didn't think it altered their offensive line approach a whole lot in Dallas. What Frederick brings is that ability to reach nose tackles in the running game. So if I'm a center and I'm snapping the ball, let's say we're running to the right and lined up over my right shoulder is a nose tackle. I've got to get my body around that guy and pin him back to my left side after I've snapped the ball. And that's extremely hard to do because snapping the ball already puts me a fraction of a beat behind on the movement, and then it's just hard to cross over a guy's body, especially early in the run like that. I don't have very much room to build up momentum. I've got to be quick. I have to use my hands, and I have to do it in a way that I can keep moving. I don't just pin the guy back inside. I've got to keep working to the outside because we're running an outside zone play. Not a lot of centers can do it. Kelsey can because he's so agile. And you'll see teams will put a nose tackle over Kelsey to try to diminish his ability to do this. Alex Mack for a lot of years has been good at it. I think Frederick, when he's at his best, is the best in the NFL at that, though.
And we actually have a lightning round question coming up on Quentin Nelson, so we'll set him aside for now. But let's go to the top 4 here. Number 4, Tyron Smith. Number 3, Jason Kelsey. We just talked about Kelsey a little bit here and what he brings to that Eagles offense. Tyron Smith, it's funny. When he's been out of the lineup, you've seen how the Dallas has just had immense problems. He's kind of wearing down, though. Is he still... I guess he's still at an all-pro level. Is he still at sort of the best tackle in the league level when he's healthy? Or are we just seeing it's been such a severe drop-off at left tackle when he's been out of the lineup?
Like he looks better because his backups are so bad?
Yeah.
It's maybe a little bit of all of the above, but I think Tyron Smith is as good as advertised. He has really long arms. That's a big deal in offensive line play. That's a big deal in a lot of positions in football. We don't talk about it enough, but I would say arm length to some degree is more important than height and weight, and certainly height. But he has long arms. He plays long. He's light on his feet. There's a springiness to him, and then on top of all of that, he has really strong hands. Most of these guys that are athletic and agile like Tyron Smith, they don't have the strongest hands because they're more athletes than maulers. Tyron Smith is both of those things. His hands are very violent and very firm. So I would err on the side of counting on Tyron Smith more than I would doubting him.
You ready for the top two?
I am. I'm sorry. This is a little, I don't know if this one's an obvious one to people.
This one, yeah, this one was more interesting. I mean, it is all the positions combined into one. So I think by definition, you're going to have something more interesting.
Well, you know what? I take it back. It would have been interesting, except you read the everybody else receiving votes. And so now it probably is a little more obvious than it would have been to some.
I don't know. I don't know about that. This guy moved. I think he's made the top 10 every year, but he's never been this high. Number two, David Bakhtiari.
Do you want to say number one, or do we want to just talk Bakhtiari?
Let's talk Bakhtiari first.
All right. I didn't realize. I think he's the smallest left tackle in the NFL. He's certainly one of the shortest. That's what it is. So I just said long arms are important. Well, David Bakhtiari is not a long-bodied guy, and yet he plays with very good leverage and a very nice anchor. Bull rushers want to bull rush him because he's got the body type that you want to bull rush. Mm-hmm. And Bakhtiari every year gets better at the bull rush. He'll give up a little bit of ground, and then he'll give up absolutely zero ground. And that's how he anchors. So he anchors a little bit later in his drop step. I like David Bakhtiari a lot, and it's not easy always to play left tackle for Aaron Rodgers because he's the type of quarterback you don't know where he's going to be at all times.
Yeah, I mean, he was I remember coming out in 2013, he was a fourth-round pick, and he played at some... He's 6'4", and he played at some, like, 285 at Colorado, and that's what puts you on the third day of the draft. But he's obviously been tremendous. And number one, Zach Martin.
Was it you? Who had Bakhtiari? So he had two first-place votes. I was one of them. Who was the other?
Zach Martin?
Yeah. Was it you or Colin?
It was me.
Okay, so Colin had Bakhtiari at number one. Zach Martin is, I think he'd be a really good tackle if he had to play there, and he has had to play there a tiny bit, but as a guard, he expands their game. The same thing we said with Travis Frederick. You can kind of apply that to Zach Martin about reach and seal blocks. Dallas does a lot of sweep runs where they get those guys out on the perimeter, and Zach Martin's a big part of that. They want to put Zach Martin out in front in space. They want to feature him in their running game. He's rock solid in pass protection, no concerns there. But he's one of the few linemen who you do build plays around. It'd be interesting if Dallas, and they're not going to have to make this decision because they've already paid Zach Martin. Mm-hmm. I would love to know if Dallas ever had to choose between Ezekiel Elliott and Zach Martin, which guy they would pick. I think I would pick Zach Martin if I had to keep just one.
Interesting. Yeah, I feel like we debated this in past years. I guess you have to go Martin at this point.
Yeah, I would. I would go Zach Martin. The other thing I can't get past, when a team is bad at guard, and this doesn't really apply to Zach Martin because we're talking about the best lineman, in our opinion, in the NFL, but just to get a snapshot of the value of the guard position as a concept, when you're bad at guard, the more I watch film, the more I think that's the hardest weakness in football to hide because of how athletic defensive tackles are, how many defensive ends now rush inside on third down, not necessarily putting their hand in the dirt as a three technique, but looping inside or coming from a stand-up position like Clowney does. Guards get attacked more than any other position on the football field offensively, and I think it's the hardest weakness in the NFL to hide offensively. Defense, I think it's cornerback.
All right. Well, there you go. That's the top 10 offensive linemen in football. We have the lightning-ish round coming up. And, of course, if you haven't been keeping up, you can go back in your feed. You can find our show on the top 10 tight ends, wide receivers, running backs, quarterbacks, and linebackers. We still got about four shows to go after this one. But right now, we are joined by Donovan Smith. Tampa Bay Buccaneers left tackle is going to give us a little more knowledge on offensive line play in the NFL. And if I could be honest, this is one of my favorite players. All right, we're here with Donovan Smith, offensive tackle. One of my favorite players. I don't know about you, Andy.
One of the steadier offensive tackles in football, for sure.
And this is what I always say. So much deep passing in Tampa. It's kind of unfair. You gotta write a new playbook or something. Do some quick strike stuff. Make your life easier.
Yeah, man. No, but hey, that's what we were the past, well, 4 years and whatnot. So you gotta do what you need to do. But yeah, we're one of the teams who would definitely drop back and throw the ball downfield. So
yeah. So we'll start it simple, and then okay. you'll make us smarter here. But just boiling it down, you have vertical sets, you have angle sets. Mm-hmm. Basically, why do you do one? Why do you do the other?
Okay.
What are the advantages?
So the advantages of a vertical set, you pretty much take what the defender can do. You know, you take it away from them. So pretty much you look at it like you got three ways to go. You go around, through, or inside, you know, as a defender. So as a vertical set, you're pretty much taking away inside right now. And then you have to just be prepared for bull rushes and speed rushes. So angle sets, you know, you're kind of giving up more – you're more susceptible for more inside moves because of how you're jumping out of a 45 and stuff like that. And a good defensive end, he's going to, you know, read that right away and then go inside. So they have their benefits, you know, 45 set, you get out there, get on them, and, you know.
45-degree angle set.
45-degree angle set, yeah, we call it angle set.
Yep.
You're able to get out there and, you know, you kind of look at it kind of like a short set where you go get your hands on them and then you widen the pocket 3 yards, 2 yards, whatever it is, and then you're normal. 9, 7, 8 yards a depth. So, you know, they have their pluses and minuses.
How much freedom do you have, especially on the vertical and the angle sets where there's Ooh. More depth in the drop, how much do you get to choose that, and how much is that built into the play design typically?
So a lot of it is based off of play design. You know, some plays, obviously, we have coded, you know, whether it's a deep pass, short pass, intermediate, and then you kind of can just, you know, go in your toolbox to pretty much, you know, figure out what you want to do. For me in Tampa, what we were coached the past 4 years was constantly vertical. Mm-hmm. So you want to be vertical, and then we have the option to go, you know, 3 steps short, which is a technique where you can start out vertical and then go close the distance if you got a wide tech.
Okay, so. Wide nine technique.
Yep, so.
So let's say it's a design, it's a vertical set, but the D end is aligned in a subtly different technique than you thought.
Right.
Do you still have to stick with the vertical set? Tell me what the adjustment is
so,
for you.
So just basically for me, talking about me, no matter what I do, I'm getting up on the line, I'm saying I'm vertical setting. Unless it's a quick throw or something like that where I can go cut or short set them, I'm going to vertical set. After I vertical set, I can make I can determine where he's at based off of what he's doing, if I can go close the distance. So if he's a loose seven to a nine or something like that, then I'm going to start vertical, see what he wants to do, and then I'm going to go close the space. So that way I'm allowing 2, 3, 4 extra yards of whatever it is, you know, width as well as, you know, depth. So it really just depends on who you're going against, what they're capable of, and the play type.
I was gonna say, are there any cues you can pick up on besides alignment? Can you see how a guy is set up that might tell you
cues for what? And just
might tell you where he's going. Might be
So yeah, it's a lot. So pretty much, you know, a lot of people just think you got to block defensive ends. You got to block everybody. You got three techniques. You got linebackers. You got safeties who may come running down. You got slot pressure, corners, and stuff like that. So you really just kind of got to look at your triangle, is what we call it. You start, you know, basically line of scrimmage. You're looking at, you know, your three tech or shade or whatever you have, whether they're aligned to the strength or not, and then basically just go from there. You look out slot, he's top the press, you look at the safety, you look at the linebackers, and then you can just go from there. Pretty much 9 times out of 10, a defense is going to tell you where they're going, just based off their alignment and how they move. So linebackers, if they're creeping, you know, different levels, you can – look for a middle dog, you know what I'm saying, where, you know, defensive end maybe dropping three technique, looping out, and they're running, you know, two backers through the middle, stuff like that. If they're going to bring in slot pressure, defensive end, you know, can be coming inside right now. But how they get you is slot pressure doesn't always mean defensive end right now. He can be the contained rusher, and they'll bring a slot guy inside.
The slot goes inside, yeah.
So, you know, it's a lot.
So let's undress that a little bit into parts and talk about just games, stunts and twists, and how you read that. I'm curious, which team that you have faced was the most challenging, specifically with four-man rush games?
Four-man rush games, That's tough. Dallas was a big pirating team.
And when you say pirate, that means crashing inside.
Yeah, that means crashing inside, canceling out gaps and stuff like that. Basically, if you want to run weak, they'll take that away knowing that you, you know, want to go to the weak side. So they're going to crash the defensive end, make you stick there and scrape a linebacker over top. It was one other team late in the year. Drawing a blank, but definitely Cowboys with pirating and stuff.
Okay, and then how about teams that bring the slot and mic pressure or linebacker, second-level pressure teams? Who's been best with that you've seen?
The Saints do that a lot. They'll bring, you know, guys off the slot, even though they're a man-playing team. Who else? Carolina does it as well.
They did a ton under Steve Wilkes a few years ago with Captain Munner.
And then... that's all I can think about right now, division-wise.
And I think I know what you're going to say on this one, but let's round it all up. Who's the best at putting that all together, exchanging gaps with
as
blitzes?
A team?
Yes.
As a team whole, exchanging gaps, blitzes, just for what they do, I'd have to say Carolina.
Okay,
Who are you going with?
I thought for sure you'd say Baltimore, who you played late in the year.
Baltimore did, but that's the old school, you know, Baltimore way, how they, you know. And that's my first time playing Baltimore. So, like, yeah, you're right. Nah, but I'm going to take Carolina just because of what they have. Their front seven and then what they have in the back end for them to be able to do what they're able to do. Keekly and, he's not there anymore. Davis, you know what I'm saying? And then they used to move around Shaq Thompson a lot. He was pretty much like the nickel wheel kind of guy, but he's playing the safety position, but he's really a linebacker. And, you know, they create difficulties.
I want to ask who's the best, the pure pass rusher you have dealt with?
Pure pass rusher. See, for me, I'm just going to go with who gave me the most problems. For me, Trent Cole, Robin Mathis for the Colts.
So my low to the ground guys.
My second year, rookie year maybe? Yeah. We played them in Indianapolis. And then Myles Garrett is really good because he reminds me of like JPP. And how Gumby he is, flexible.
That's a great point.
And his speed and power. So with all of that, you can think he's coming at you one way, and then he'll, you know, dip out of the way. And it's like, whoa, what you doing?
I believe he would make, if they had the right edge guys around him, I think he would make an excellent nickel pass rusher. We're talking third and long situations. But you've played
Myles
Garrett.
Kick what him are
you,
inside.
Yeah.
You saying kick him inside?
Yeah.
Why?
Because of what you said about the Gumby thing, the different directions, the quick, violent hands. Aaron Donald's small.
It's a different ball game. But for Myles Garrett, his thing is based off of he has those long strides and he's able to close the distance quick enough to where you can't really gauge his steps. You know what I'm saying? Whether he's coming on 2, 3, or 4 making his move, depending on what he's doing. So.
That's an interesting point.
I just think that.
So you're saying he is a deceptive mover in space, and you want to give him as much space as possible then?
No, you
No, as a defense.
If you're on defense. But if he plays inside, not saying he can't because he's a great player, but if he plays inside, most likely guys are going to try and, you know, get their hands on him, you know, right now, because then it limits what he's able to do inside versus when he's outside.
Seems like it's harder to double, and I think Donald has unearthed this year. It's harder schematically to give help to guards against dominant three techniques than it is to give tackles help against dominant edge rushers.
Yeah, so a lot of what you see is a lot of teams, they like to, you know, slide that way. So they have a three-man slide going to him, and then, you know, you'll be man, guard, tackle on the backside or whatever. But sometimes it doesn't work.
It's not enough.
It doesn't work because just like, you know, guys are smart enough to figure out how to control them, the same, you know, defensive coaches are doing the same thing. Like, okay, well, they're going to slide this way. We're going to make sure we bring something another way. And then now you're going to make them respect what they're going to bring the opposite way, and then you free up Aaron Donald. Plus, he can do whatever he wants. He's Aaron Donald. Like, you know what I'm saying? So he has really, I don't think in terms of like rush lanes and stuff like that, he's just like, go. You feel me? You beat your man, beat whatever you do, do whatever you got to do. But that's what makes him great.
I like putting everyone inside just because the inside guys don't block as well as the tackles. So I like those matchups better.
I mean, it'll be interesting. It's like JPP, he plays inside. Y'all probably don't see it, but in practice, he plays inside. He's pretty good at it because he's, you know, savvy. He knows how to set you up. He's able to read you and stuff like that. And
why would he practice inside and then play? And I know he's not a pure edge guy, right. But why would he practice inside and then play defensive end almost exclusively on Sundays? Why spend the reps in practicing?
The more that you can do, the better, and just help out the young guys. So he gets up there, he rushes.
And then they say, do it like he did it.
You beat somebody. What'd you see? What'd you do? Why'd you do that? He'll go back, explain it, help the young guys out. So it's just a way to help the young guys out rather than just me telling you, okay, yeah, go over there, rush him on his outside, come back inside, blah, 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 this, down the third. I'm going to show you. And then I want you to go do it. So then that way you can see it.
Yeah.
And then you can see what I say when it works. So
we all set?
I mean,
we could do this all day with
him, but yeah, you're right.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, hey, we appreciate you.
Definitely.
Thank you.
That was great, man. Thanks a lot. Yep.
All right. We're not done quite yet. We still have the lightning-ish round. Are you ready, Andy?
I am ready.
All right. Fastest 4 hours in podcasting. If Dallas has the best offensive line in the NFL, who is second best?
I would say Pittsburgh with
yeah.
a nod to Eagles fans. If Eagles fans want to say, no, it's Philadelphia. And they might say, well, ours is actually better than Dallas. So I think it's Dallas 1, Pittsburgh 2. Who would you go?
Yeah, same thing with me. We kind of spoiled that answer literally. So let's go to a better one here. True or false, by the end of 2019, you know what? I'm going to change it from true or false. I'm going to say, what percentage chance does Quentin Nelson have of becoming the best guard in football in 2019?
False.
I never should have started with the true or false. Put a number on it, Andy.
To answer the second part of your question, I would say 20%, I guess. He's okay. Very good. I think he's already the best left guard.
Okay. All right, that's fair enough. Rapid fire, Hall of Fame or not? For these three guys, Marshall Yanda.
And this is the knee-jerk reaction. So it's just kind of, some people would say that's the Hall of Fame test. I don't quite buy into that. I think you ought to think about it before you vote for the Hall of Fame. But Marshall Yanda, to me, no, not quite.
Andrew Whitworth.
No, unless he plays at this level next year, this 2019 season, and they win the Super Bowl, then maybe, but I'd say I don't think so.
Ooh. I disagree with both those. Joe Staley.
You think they're both Hall of Famers?
Yeah, I think they are.
Staley, I would also say no.
Okay. Yeah, I'm kind of.
I
know
Whitworth's
Staley.
A Hall of Famer.
I do.
What makes you say? I'm looking up his accolades now.
But his accolades, he was overlooked for too many years, and he was an elite player at two positions. And he's also been a really good player for a really long time. He was one of those guys who was just always like one off the All-Pro vote for the All-Pro team for years and years.
You know, there's nothing wrong with being a really, really good player and not being in the Hall of Fame.
I agree. I agree entirely. And I would actually argue Marshall Yanda, I probably would not vote for myself, but I think he will get in.
Whitworth has two All-Pro teams to his name, 2015 and 2017.
Yep.
He'd be another one for our all, even though you're saying he was good in Cincinnati, and he was. He's been better with the Rams, I would say, than he was as a Bengal.
Yeah.
And he's in his late 30s. Marshall Yanda, I'm trying to think how Hall of Fame voters will see him. 7-time Pro Bowl. That doesn't mean anything, though, because I don't know. Pro Bowl, are they injury replacement guys or what are they? 2-time first-team All-Pro. 4-time second-team All-Pro. Yeah, maybe.
Very big with grading services. I think that's what pushes him over the top. I think that's how a lot of people look at it who cover the league right now and also have a Hall of Fame vote.
You do?
I do.
Right now, I think there's an old guard and a new guard in the Hall of Fame room from what I hear. And I don't know if they necessarily love each other. The new guard would have the grading factor into their votes. I don't know if the old guard would quite as much. Maybe they would. Peter King's, I guess, probably one of the leaders of the old guard, and he really respects grading.
He does. He does. I think Yanda's getting in. Last one, breakout player or underappreciated star. Who do you got, Andy?
I'm going to defer to you first while I think about it, because I forgot to do this one in my head. Again, this is like, what did we do on Sunday nights? We'd always do the awards or something. I was never prepared.
Yep, you would have amnesia at that exact point every night.
I would. It felt like that all the time. Like, I just, it's a broad question. If you ever are, like, if you're a radio host listening to this show and you have a guest on, asking these broad questions is almost impossible for the guest because it's too many things to think about. And what, you expect me to be prepared going in? You expect me to have thought about this before we record? Come on.
This is only like our 112th show together, so we're just getting used to it. I don't think this guy is that underappreciated. And actually, when I saw him on our rankings, I was like, oh my goodness, I can't believe he's this low. Anders Peet came in 18th, and I was outraged. And then I saw I only had him voted 12th, so I really shouldn't be that upset about it. But I think Anders Peet is an all-pro player this year. I think the injuries got to him a year ago, but I think he is a guy we'll probably put in the top 10 next year.
Okay. I would probably say Ryan Kelly for the Colts, their center. Yeah. He is almost as valuable within the context of their scheme as Quentin Nelson is. And it's interesting, there are three teams right now, maybe four if you count Brandon Brooks with the Eagles and Jason Kelsey. Brooks is coming off a serious injury, though. Late season. What is it, his Achilles? Like in January this year?
Mm-hmm.
But there are three other teams that have an amazing guard center combination. The Colts with Nelson and Ryan Kelly, and then the Cowboys we talked about, Zach Martin and Travis Frederick, and then the Steelers with David DeCastro and Marquise Pouncey. You can do a lot of things when you have two high level interior offensive linemen.
All right. That's a wrap. It's a good show, if I do say so myself. That's going to do it for now. We will be back next week with another one of our, Andy, I think maybe edge rushers next week. Maybe.
That'd be cool with me. I like edge rushers.
Okay. We'll see. You'll have to tune in and find out. But that'll do it for now. Thanks to our researchers, Reed Foster and Ryan Taylor. Colin Bowers checking in as our third voter this week. And, of course, thank you to Donovan Smith for the time. His time is so much more valuable for us with that than ours is with that new contract. So
I was just going to say, he's rich. He's richer than us.
He is.
That was kind of him.
He is. And thank you, as always, to producer Brandon Nix. Best in the business. Most of all, thank you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. We have lots of homework for you guys. You got to send all average team. You got to send all second act team. Or if you just want to send us notes or questions or whatever you might think of, talkback@themmqb.com is always the best avenue. We are both on Twitter. We are both on Facebook. You can get us there if you really want to. And of course, if you don't already, please subscribe to the MMQB podcast family wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Radio.com/10things, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We'll see you guys next week.